As you know, I've been working on this history of the phonograph industry now for many, many, many years. And it's like the, like a game I used to play as a kid. It was called Never Ending. But I had carried the Berliner part of it up to 1898 or 99, but I had neglected the early other parts of the history and had really only gone up to about 1888. So getting older, I thought it might be an idea to backtrack and fill in the material and hope I live long enough to get up to 1901, you know, with Johnson and Victor. So anyway, that's the reason for this sort of disjointed segment today. Let me fill in a little of the background before this part of the paper begins. Edison had invented the phonograph in 1877. He had abandoned it by 1880. Experimental work had started on the part of Alexander Graham Bell. And Bell and his assistants, Tainter and his relative from the British Isles, then proceeded to develop their version of the phonograph, the graphophone. It was demonstrated in Washington, and suddenly Edison, who had felt that the phonograph had gone as far as he could make it, started to experiment again. And so the can of worms began to get really full. To make it even worse, Bell had, and his associates, had formed the Volta Laboratory Association. Volta itself sold the rights to another group, the Volta Graphophone Company. This particular group then sold the rights to a group of promoters, the American Graphophone Company, and we're beginning to get into familiar names now. The American Graphophone Company was, strangely enough, to be run by a group of promoters, and the organization was very much like an organization, or many of the organizations of the period, in which these promoters were general agents of the company. And so the general agents of the company began to promote it. Most of them were, by the way, had been stenographers in Washington and were congressional reporters. Complicated, isn't it? They began to demonstrate their new graphophone, and a person who had made his money in mining in South America, I believe it was Honduras, was a person by the name of Thomas R. Lombard. Lombard sees the graphophone demonstrated, and Lombard, after the demonstration, thinks this is something that has possibilities. And so along with a group or a syndicate, which he has put together, they begin to negotiate with the general agents to take over and to market the graphophone. The negotiations go through the spring of 1888 when the graphophone people decide they do not want to negotiate with Lombard. And then what happens is that they then start negotiating with another member of the syndicate by the name of Jesse Lippincott, which we may have heard of in the history, and you certainly will hear more about it. Lippincott carries the negotiations through to success, and we get to the beginnings of this particular segment. The agreement that Jesse Lippincott had signed with the graphophone company gave him certain thoughts after the fact, because he began to realize that Edison was also working on the scene, even though Edison had abandoned it. And Edison was working on the scene with a person by the name of Ezra T. Gilliland. Gilliland and Edison are working quite rapidly to catch up on lost ground. And Lippincott realizes that he's got a lot of problems ahead of him unless he tries to settle with Edison. He negotiates with Gilliland, who was the general agent, notice again, agents, for the Edison Phonograph Company, and he succeeds with getting Gilliland interested. Gilliland is approached, apparently from the looks of things, by Lippincott, and Lippincott tries to sweeten the deal that if he can get Edison to agree to the sell the phonograph, that he will allow Gilliland to sign a second contract in which he will be paid in North American or the proposed company stock, and he will then be allowed, if he wishes, only if he wishes, to present that stock for payment in 2 or 3 installments. It is a similar agreement which Lippincott had also signed with James C. Clefane, who was one of the general agents of the American Graphophone Company. So my feeling is that this type of deal, I can't prove it, I can prove the fact that there was the one with Clefane, because that agreement was in the Lippincott assignment for the benefit of creditors later. Anyway, it would seem logical that Gilliland and Tomlinson had not suggested this, but that it was Lippincott. Now let's get on to the actual paper itself. The agreement between Jesse Lippincott and Edison contained 2 model contracts, which were suggested as the form of agreement between the proposed phonograph company and Edison and the Edison Phonograph Works. These call for the organization of a company to introduce both the graphophone and the phonograph, that the phonograph should be of a certain character, and that the graphophone thereafter be called the phonograph graphophone, should also be of a certain character, and that the Edison Phonograph Work should have the sole and exclusive right to manufacture the phonograph and the various devices and apparatus used in conjunction therewith and supplied therefore in perpetuity. The agreement also called for a method to establish the characteristics of the phonograph to the satisfaction of the American Graphophone Company. In order to properly identify any uniqueness, it was proposed that a current model would be submitted for examination and identification. The machine, after a thorough examination, would have the identifying remarks of the individuals involved scratched onto the machine. The instrument would then be returned to the new company and placed in its custody. Henceforth, no new improvement could be appropriated by either the American Graphophone Company Group or the Edison Phonograph Company Group. In other words, the graphophone was to be unique and the phonograph was to be unique, and never the twain should meet. If the future could be foretold, initial events indicated a stormy and unquiet future. After the strain of the negotiating sessions, Lippincott departed for a summer home in Pennsylvania. Here it was discovered that his son had developed malignant diphtheria, which would delay his return to New York. Gilliland reported that this would be July 13th. Thankfully, the son did recover. By July 12th, A.O. Tate had rounded up the majority of the outstanding stock certificates of the Edison Phonograph Company. and turned them over to Tomlinson. The following day, Lippincott reported to the American Graphophone Company that the first payment had been made to Edison and that the stock had been deposited in trust at the Garfield Safe Deposit Company. With the receipt and the deposit of the stock, the financier was now free to establish a company in New Jersey. He now had second thoughts about concerning its proposed name, feeling that North American Phonograph Company was more descriptive of the territorial limits of the organization than American Phonograph Company, which was its proposed original name. Thomas R. Lombard recorded objecting to so long a name, but stated that it was because we control both the United States and Canada, and Canada was not exactly America, so they called it the North American, as embracing both the United States and Canada. Once a name was established, a company was rushed into existence, the certificate of organization being filed on July 14, 1888. Jersey City was listed as the principal place of business within New Jersey, but New York, the United States, and Canada were noted as other places in which it was proposed to conduct business. The charter allowed for the organization to trade in phonographs and phonograph graphophones and all materials appertaining to the art or science of recording and reproducing sound, and for the purpose of purchasing materials thereof, or any other purposes incidental to the business, trading, and manufacturing aforesaid. Capital stock was set at only $6,600,000, expressed as 66,000 shares with a par valuation of $100 each. Charter was to have a duration of 50 years. On the 17th, Lippincott transferred the agreement with Edison and the American Graphophone Company to the new company in exchange for only $6,560,000 of its capital stock. You see, his idea obviously was, you run in here, you organize a company, you then peddle the stock almost immediately, then you get the money to pay for all of this. The remaining shares were those that had been subscribed by the incorporators to satisfy the charter provisions for them to serve as directors. Lippincott also agreed to procure any authority required from the Edison speaking phonograph company or to protect the company from interference from the Edison speaking phonograph company. You see what a real mess the whole situation is. Speaking Phonograph Company was the first company that was organized in 1878. Under their agreements with Edison, they were to have the rights to any improvements that were made on the phonograph during the 14-year term of the American patent. Now, if Edison made any improvements during the 14-year term, 1878, you had 14 years, 1892. And if he made some new improvements in 1891, that would tie everything up to 1905. So you can see what the problem is. So they had to do something with the Edison Speaking Phonograph Company. Now, or to protect the company from interference from the said Edison Speaking Phonograph Company, but at the expense of the company if a license fee or royalty were to be paid, nothing herein contained shall be considered as an agreement on the part of Lippincott to sell or transfer to said company any stock of said Edison Speaking Phonograph Company which he has acquired or may acquire by purchase or otherwise. Even though he had not made an agreement with the major stockholders, he already had secured Edison shares as a result of his recent agreement of June. Notwithstanding the formal organization of the North American Phonograph Company, it was necessary to renegotiate all the contracts with the American Graphophone Company to allow it to handle both the graphophone as well as the phonograph. The first move was to formally establish the characteristics of the machines, as I have mentioned previously. One of the improved machines was taken down to Washington by Cleveland Walcott, the secretary of the new company. Here it was examined by the officers and directors of the Graphophone Company, who scratched their private marks on the bedplate of the instrument. The device was then returned to New York and placed in the custody of the company. I'm wondering if that machine has survived. You have it with the initial scratch down? That's it. Before I publish this, let me know the serial number so I can put it in my footnote. July 21st, 1888. How many did they have? They may have had to run it right down there because they may not have had it. The perfected one went to England. You know, the result of the experimental bit. Lippincott had made a formal application to handle a phonograph through Austin Herr, the secretary of the American Graphophone Company. The Lippincott financial situation was very serious, for the new contracts called for the financier to make large cash outlays, and should he become involved in anything that might unduly delay his plans, he faced almost certain ruin. One other side remark here. Everyone puts pictures Lippincott as this almost sugar daddy who had all of this cash from selling his interest in the Rochester Tumbler Company, Rochester, Pennsylvania, by the way, not Rochester, New York. He still had his holdings in Rochester Tumbler. The thing was that he had this idea that he could pyramid this North American phonograph company and get his money right out of it. But the mess that he got into right away at the beginning doomed that idea, and then the problems really began. His contracts with Edison called for payments of $115,000 on September the 1st, $125,000 on October the 1st, and $250,000 on November the 1st. He was also going to have to come to some agreement with the stockholders of the old Edison Speaking Phonograph Company, which from all indications was going to be much more expensive than Edison had led him to believe. Uriah Hunt Painter, the main driving force, was already threatening a re-entry into the market as a means of exerting pressure on Lippincott. Because of the early contract details, he felt confident that he could use any new Edison improvements without any opposition, since the 1878 contract called for the inventor to turn over any improvements made during the years of the patent. This could provide possible roadblocks for Lippincott into the foreseeable future. The Lippincott proposals were placed before the board of the American Graphophone Company at the meeting of July 24, 1888. Although he had obviously acted with the full knowledge and encouragement of the company, several of the directors now had second thoughts and proposed that alterations would have to be made before the new arrangement would become acceptable. There was enough opposition to defeat a motion to appoint a committee to handle the matter. An informal recess was then called in which the opposing factions could attempt to arrive at some consensus. On formally resuming the meeting in the evening, it was agreed that if Lippincott could secure Edison's assent to a proposed list of modifications, the board would agree to change its agreement to allow the hapless financier to handle the phonograph. Unfortunately, the list of proposed changes has not survived. A few days later, Lippincott was able to report to the graphophone people. He agrees to all the changes and modifications that outlined, except to change the name of the company. As the Graphophone Company does not intend to do business with the Phonograph Company, but with me as an individual, don't you think that that point is of minor importance and can be waived by your board? The amended agreement showed the following changes. One, the rights to the proposed June contract were to be held by the proposed American Phonograph Company. They would now be split. The company would control the phonograph, but the rights to the graphophone were to be exercised through Jesse Lippincott as sole licensee. The standard machines provided for in the Edison agreement might be modified by patented improvements, but the two rivals were forbidden to adopt features that were exclusive to the other. All phonographs sold must carry the patent numbers of the patents owned or controlled by the Edison Phonograph Company, but in addition, also would have to list those controlled by the Volta Graphophone Company. This must have really rubbed salt into Edison's wounds, because to have the opposition's patents as the controlling patents in this particular thing. A stated royalty would be due the Graphophone Company for every Edison phonograph acquired by the North American Phonograph Company. From that time onward, the North American Phonograph Company's letterhead carried the rather cumbersome designation, the North American Phonograph Company and Jesse H. Lippincott, sole licensee of the American Graphophone Company. The situation was now clouded enough to provide legions of lawyers work for years to come. Presumably, the reason for the insistence of the American Graphophone Company in refusing to transfer Lippincott's license to the new company was to ensure that its performance bondsmen would be held to their obligation should Lippincott find it impossible to carry out his part of the terms of the agreement. If this occurred, both Whitney and Robinson, the bondsmen, could be held accountable, as was later to prove the case. The Graphophone Company was informed on August the 9th that Robinson had signed the new performance agreement and that Whitney would do so on receipt of the papers in Pittsburgh. It should also be noted that a further proviso had been signed by the Graphophone Company and Lippincott. A secret option was agreed upon and executed that would allow the purchase of the Edison Phonograph Company and the Edison Speaking Phonograph Company should the Graphophone Company decide to do so within the following 5 years. The option was brought to Edison's attention on several occasions by letters of notification from the American Graphophone Company, but as you can see, was never utilized. Now, the stage is set for other problems. American Graphophone, its first machines, had been manufactured by the Western Electric Company. They were slow in doing it. There were cost overruns on it. And I think Western Electric felt it was just too expensive a proposition. And so they decided to pretty much get out of the contract because they quoted such a high price that the Graphophone Company refused to do business with them further. So they then decided to try and get the Graphophone manufactured elsewhere. So they submitted bids to several possible manufacturers and even obtained detailed estimates from some, but eventually the decision was made in May to explore the possibility of entering into its own manufacturing. A building had been found in Bridgeport, Connecticut, suitable for either purpose, and after the necessary examination of the premises, title, etc., was leased for the term of 5 years at an annual rental of $4,500 with such privileges to the Graphophone Company as were necessary, including that of removing their plant and equipment at the termination of their lease or occupancy. A contract was then made with Mr. James H. Savell and Professor Tainter to undertake the immediate charge and manufacture of the manufacturing. The plant was located in one wing of the reorganized but still ailing Howe Sewing Machine Company. This arrangement allowed easy access to sewing machine treadles, for these were to be the chief motive power of the early graphophone. Meanwhile, Lippincott was unwilling to have the North American Phonograph Company begin full operations until its relations with the old Edison Speaking Phonograph Company had been regularized. This company had been making threatening gestures and was hinting that it soon would be placing its own machine on the market. The details of the old Edison contract, as we had seen, had given them the rights to any improvements in the years after the issuance of the first phonograph patent. Sigmund Bergman, one of the members of the company, was already lifting Edison's improvements and preparing a new phonograph. In order to prepare for any eventuality by the Painter Board of Directors, a meeting was called on July 25th in Washington, D.C. At the meeting, the minutes of a meeting which were mentioned in the previous installment in Norwalk, Connecticut, were ratified, and new officers nominated and voted upon. The following positions were filled: Uriah Hunt Painter, president; Josiah C. Reif, vice president; James R. Ash, secretary. Uriah H. Painter was also elected treasurer, and A.H. Byington of the Norwalk Gazette was nominated treasurer. Was nominated treasurer, okay. The necessary shares had recently been issued by Painter to allow the service of the new officers. Edward H. Johnson, who had been involved with the development of the phonograph, was conspicuously absent from the slate. Two resolutions were proposed and accepted. Whereas there has been presented to the board inventions alleged to be of vital consequence in making the speaking phonograph a practical business success. Therefore, resolved that the managing committee be directed to fully investigate the subject, and they are hereby authorized to purchase such inventions if deemed valuable, provided such inventions can be secured for not exceeding $50,000 cash. Imagine Edison taking the $50,000 if they proposed it to him. Wherefore, a form of contract was presented to the board providing for the construction of 5,000 speaking phonographs. Therefore, resolved that the whole subject of making a contract for the manufacture of phonographs be referred to the managing committee with full power to complete the details of such contract, provided the cost shall not exceed $50 for each phonograph. On August the 14th, when requesting samples of wax from some cylinders of the other party, Sigmund Bergman was reported that I expect to have my phonograph finished this week and think it will be a perfect success. Almost immediately, this information was communicated to J.C. Reif. Bergman is completing his machine, which he is confident will net the company $100,000. I have a good party at work in Philadelphia on another plan, and Edward H. Johnson has yet to be heard from on his patent that we are to buy for $50,000. By the 17th, Painter was able to exult. Lippincott, who owns the North American Phonograph Company, has been crowding Edison to stand in and help get the old phonograph company out of the way that he supposed that he had it provided for when he made the deal with him, but that my getting Hubbard stock had upset all of his plans. After an inquiry from Lippincott, he had replied that I shall at the proper time come down and shut up the whole outfit if infringes, unless they very soon take proper steps to secure a license from us. He reported that Edison was to get $125,000 on September the 1st, and that the rights to New York City had been sold for $100,000 cash and one quarter of the new company's stock. And I put emphasis on this: we are masters of the situation if we don't go off half-cocked. You see what a whole murky situation this thing is. Johnson was busy in New York seeing that the proper information was leaked to the proper sources. He managed to discuss the situation with a Mr. F.L. Smithers, who was a member of the firm that had been asked to place the stock of the new local phonograph company for the city of New York, the Metropolitan Phonograph Company. He said that it was a good thing, a big thing, but Smithers was buying the biggest lawsuit he ever heard of. Smithers then intimated that the issue would not be floated unless they have settled with you. Johnson also was able to leak details of the situation to a reporter for the New York Herald, who apparently contacted Lippincott for corroboration. The financier was able to suppress the story when he hastened to assure the newspaper man that he was arranging an interview with Painter, in which he was certain that any problem with the old company could be settled amicably. Personally, my aim all along has been to avoid any litigation in any form. Lippincott soon communicated with Edison concerning Johnson's position. That Johnson did not propose to get anything out of Edison, but he did propose to get something out of me. The amount of something was unspecified. The uncertainty concerning the old company was soon translated in a tangible way to Edison. On September the 1st, Lippincott stated that he was not prepared to make that payment. No money has been received by me as yet from the sub-organizations on account of what Mr. Johnson told a banker a few days ago. I suspended operations in the matter of promotion of the stock of the company until our differences are arranged and I can go before the public without fear of opposition in that particular quarter. I expect to be able to make you a payment next week before the 10 days expire. But if you have not actual use for the money before the 26th of September, I would consider it a great favor if you would extend the time on a portion of it until that date. Obviously, Lippincott was holding back in order to have sufficient cash to settle with the old company. He was in the position of requiring capital to pay Edison, but unless he could settle with the members of the old company, he could not acquire that capital by the sale of stock or territorial rights. Lippincott attempted to protect himself by offering an option to Painter of $42,212 for 10,687 shares. He was also negotiating with Charles A. Cheever for a possible purchase of an additional 10,944 shares for $54,262. On September the 21st, Samuel Insull was authorized to purchase approximately 10,800 shares of the Edison Speaking Phonograph Company from Painter for $225,000, payable in five installments, $15,000 on signing, the remainder in four equal payments on the 15th day of October, November, December, and January of the following year. The agreement signed on September the 24th actually involved 10,927 shares in exchange for the $225,000. The company was now with Edison stock that had been acquired as part of the June agreement, effectively in Lippincott's control. While we do not have the details of the Cheever negotiations, Cheever's close contact with the Metropolitan Phonograph Company and the New England Phonograph Company gave him leverage to make sure of the sale of his stock. The payments to Painter were made on or close to the required dates so that by January, the company belonged to Lippincott. By the way, as far as I can see, these payments and possibly payments to Gilliland and Tomlinson were the only real money that did manage to make it through at this particular time. By the end of August, disquieting rumors began to percolate back to Edison concerning the Gilliland-Tomlinson negotiations with Lippincott. The stalled nature of any negotiations that North American might have with promoters anxious to set up local companies gave Edison the opening he needed. He agreed to consider the postponement of payments if Lippincott obliged him by informing him of the exact nature of the arrangements between Mr. Gilliland and Lippincott, which would assist his judgment in deciding upon the request. Edison's suspicion that he had been unfairly treated by Gilliland and the possible obstacle of the old phonograph company now affected his other relationships. up until that period, he had operated on an almost equal level with a group of close cronies, but he now began to cut himself away from them. Within the next few years, almost all of these relationships were ended. Johnson, whose actions in the Edison speaking phonograph company negotiations made him particularly visible, had also been associated with Frank Sprague in the development of the trolley. Injudicious remarks to Henry Villard, the financier, finally tipped the scales as far as Edison was concerned. He poured out his frustrations in a long memo, which exists in several states of the Edison National Historic Site and among the Painter papers. A similar memo was penned to Sigmund Bergman, presumably as a result of his actions in protesting his actions concerning the phonograph and the electric light. Both communications represent bitter, frustrated diatribes by an individual who was coming to believe that all his former colleagues had become turncoats. Edison must have communicated his willingness to allow Lippincott to delay the payment to him. A $65,000 portion of the September 1st amount was received on September the 10th, and the remainder of $60,000 was promised for the 26th. As evidenced by the delay, Lippincott must have communicated to Edison the details of the secret contract with Gilliland. As a result, Edison became frantic, since he considered the money rightfully his. He felt he would have received a much better price if Lippincott did not have such a contract to contend with. But Edison had agreed to it. Immediately, moves were set into motion to attempt to recover the money. The first was to have the board of directors of the Edison Phonograph Company formally remove the general agent. Whereas Mr. Ezra T. Gilliland has made an attempt to sell and assign his personal agency contract with his company under date 28th October of 1887 to Jesse Lippincott of the City of New York, and has executed papers to that effect, and without the permission of this company, therefore by divesting his said contract of the sole consideration contained therein for making it. That is, the said Gilliland's personal services and responsibilities. Well, I won't go into all the details of that, but basically, Gilliland, for a year and a half, had been working without any salary or anything else promoting the company. And a lot of the value of that company consisted in the results of Gilliland's actions and also Gilliland's improvements on the phonograph, because Spectacle was his. And by the way, you notice that the Spectacle machine goes right, is discontinued almost immediately? Guess why? Whose contract was it? Whose patent was it? It was Gilliland's. The resolution was communicated to Jesse Lippincott with a warning that any payments made to Gilliland would be made at his own risk. Gilliland and Tomlinson had sailed for Europe in August after demanding the first payment for their stock at par from Lippincott. Edison was now quick to contact Gilliland, who was in touch with Edison's English representative, Colonel Gouraud. Gouraud was also warned not to have dealings with either individual. Gilliland immediately replied, "Sale made to Lippincott exactly as represented and had your approval." Lippincott volunteered to make the subsequent agreement and had good object in doing so. "I see nothing underhanded in this transaction. Your interests were in no way injured therefore. I throughout acted under Tomlinson's advice. You certainly are acting without knowledge of facts and are doing one great injustice. Have in this matter in all times worked faithfully in your interest shall return at once." Well, what happened is that Edison almost immediately brought suit against Gilliland. The suit was thrown out of court, was reinstated, thrown out of court again, dragged on. Nothing ever happened to it, except that a lot of documentation was generated as a result for a researcher. It helps. You get a lot of details of the companies that were to be organized of the company. Anyway, as I say, you can see why this thing was is relatively short as it is, because this thing is a real mare's nest to go through. The next installment of this exciting saga, which I hope to be able to deliver next year, will be on the organization of the local companies, which will probably take two presentations, one to carry it through to the bankruptcy of North America, and then to carry it through after that. Then my next proposed part for you will be the automatic phonograph exhibition company and the beginnings of commercial recording. And then the next one will be the final history of North American and the transshipments to England. And then finally, we will go back to the rest of the Berliner saga, 1899 to 1900. I've got the Y2 bug, I guess, also. But anyway, so far it's been fun, but I'm getting old enough that I figure I better get clicking on this again and get this stuff going. So I hope I didn't confuse you too much with this, and I hope that I have illuminated a little bit about what was happening in those 3 or 4 months, which really set the groundwork for what we are collecting today. So thank you very much. Oh, any questions? Gosh, you mean I didn't confuse everyone?
Was anything at all being sold during that period of time?
Not as far as I know. One thing I didn't mention, which will be in the other thing, part of the problem that Lippincott had once North American really started was the fact that the Edison phonograph works hadn't been completed as yet. So once they started manufacturing, you had all of the problems of a new product that had really not been sufficiently tried. The same thing was true with the American Graphophone Company. They're going into their own manufacturing. And so, first of all, American Graphophone was late in delivering its machines so that the local companies missed the initial spurt that they needed. Edison was late with it, and the early machines were really unreliable, and the local companies were then saddled with the expense of keeping these things in operation. So really, the $40 rental that they were to get was not enough. Another question. Yeah.
You said that the spectacle device was strictly taken from the market because of the...
Because of Gilliland controlling the patent. Yeah, but as I say, basically Edison, wherever he could, would go ahead and get rid of any chance away from Gilliland. I will have to look at that a little more closely. Maybe I'm making an assumption I should not make. Any other questions?